Hour 10 will feature a National Press Club address by astronomer Carl Sagan on the subject of the advantages and the perils of modern space technology. At about 3:50, Christiane Vaillancourt will report on the People's Light and Theater Company production of Kabuki Othello. With me now is Spike Lee, the writer, director, editor, and co-star of the new comedy film She's Gotta Have It, currently playing at the Ritz in Philadelphia. A lot of critics and viewers think Spike Lee is the new director and actor to watch out for. She's Gotta Have It is about a young black career woman who loves sex and plenty of variety, so she has three boyfriends. One is a sensitive and serious guy who writes poetry. One is the ultra-narcissist male model. Before sex, he neatly smooths and folds his T-shirt and shorts. And the third, played by Spike Lee, is a flaky, jive-talking guy who always wears sneakers and kazows, those oversized gold-plated glasses, and a huge 18-carat nameplate on a neck chain. The music was scored by Spike Lee's father, jazz bassist Bill Lee. In some cities, the trailer for the film has had the impact of a cult film. In the coming attraction, Spike Lee is on the street with a boombox, hawking tube socks to finance his film. He looks into the camera and pleads with the audience to buy tickets for his new movie, or else he'll be out on the streets selling socks the rest of his life. She's Gotta Have It has been so well received and is so cheaply made that Lee should have no trouble making back that investment. The film was shot in black and white in 12 days for the amazingly low sum of $175,000. Spike Lee is a recent graduate of NYU Film School. This is his first theatrically distributed film. Welcome to Fresh Air. I loved your movie and I'm glad you're here.
Thank you.
It's interesting to me that your movie is not about the plight of being black, because it seems that many of the films by black writers or starring black actors are about the plight of being black, if you know what I mean, whereas your movie, that's not the subject. But it's, you know, being black is implicit in it. You know what I'm saying?
It's black, but it's not black.
That's not what I'm saying.
Well.
Oh, is that what you're saying?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. What do you mean?
Well, I think it's so black that it's universal.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because it's about one specific thing. I think that's the way you achieve universality. You don't achieve it by, well, we have one Puerto Rican character and one Jewish character, one Chinese character. That's not going to get it.
Did you intentionally want to make it a sex comedy because there just haven't... It seems to be a genre that in America is largely reserved for whites, the sex comedy.
Well, I really don't think it's just filmed as a comedy.
You don't think it's a comedy?
I mean, it's funny, but it's not really a comedy. I feel it's more of a dramatic film. And with all black cast, I think it's... Ireland thought it'd be more... It would be easy to market this film as a comedy. But in my mind, it's not a comedy. It's funny, though.
Mm-hmm. Why did you turn around the story in a way? And I'm thinking that the angle of someone who likes a lot of sex and a lot of variety is usually a typically male type of character. That's how it's usually portrayed and that's how it's usually perceived. But you have the woman being the one who likes a lot of sex and wants a lot of lovers.
Oh, it's the truth. I mean, you just don't see it. And we want to talk about the double standard of how men could do this and it's okay. But if women like to do this, she's automatically labeled a nymphomaniac, a slut, a prostitute, a hoe. And it's not the case at all. Also, Nola is being honest. Most men, when they are seeing various women, would never fess up to each one that they are not the only one. That they will tell them that they're the only one. Baby, I love you. You're the only one. Then go over here and say the same thing down the line. But Nola's not like that. She's very upfront and honest. So the three men, Jamie, Mars, and Greer, they all know about each other.
Do you think a lot of men really fantasize of a woman who wants it all the time, but once they meet someone like that, they just can't handle it, and all they can think of is how to tame her?
I never really thought about that, but I know that a lot of women would like to lead their life with the freedom that Nola does, because she's leading her life as a man as far as relationships go. But you know, the stigma that is attached to that, you know, with all the names and all the other stuff that comes upon it, that they don't go ahead and do that.
There's one sequence in the movie where she's talking about all the men who've given her lines, and there's basically a lineup of all the men doing their lines. Could you repeat
the dogs.
What some the dogs? Yeah, could you repeat what some of them are?
Well, the scene is Nola says that men say some stupid things. You know, very weak, and then we cut to a parade of 12 men looking straight into the camera, talking to the audience, using their best, what they feel are their best lines, or to Nola, lines like, "Baby, you so fine, I could drink a tub of your bath water." And three men say, "I love you, I love you, I love you." Another guy says, "Let's go to my house right now and do the wild thing." "Let's get loose." Stuff like that.
How did you get, did you write these for them, or did you actually tell people who you know to give their best lines to the camera?
Some I wrote, some people told me.
How'd you find the actors to do that? Were they friends of yours? Or?
Yeah, all those 12 men, the dogs, they're all friends of mine.
Some women are kind of surprised that a man has noticed how absurd some lines like that sound. Mm. And I wonder, from your perspective, from the male perspective, what's interesting and funny about it to you? Do you feel like they're your competition?
Well, I don't feel it's my competition. What I find sad about that is that those lines, they work some of the time. And then it makes you think about the state of the women that, you know, do they go for that stuff? That's it. If that stuff, these lines are crazy. But men wouldn't continue the same if they didn't work once in a while.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. How do you find out about these lines? Through men who you know who brag to you, or through women who confide in you?
You could just be with your friends and hear them talking to women.
You've cast yourself in the movie as the flaky, streetwise, jive-talking guy. What was the appeal of that role to you?
Well, it was only halfway through writing the script that I decided I should play a role of Morris Blackman. I thought I could do it. I never had any acting lessons or never acted before in anything. But I felt that I was the right person for the role.
You seem very restrained in person compared to the movie.
Yeah, people get disappointed because they expect me to be Morris Blackman. They expect you to be... People expect actors to be the people, the roles they portray in films. And to me, that's crazy. I mean, so I am kind of quiet. And I'm sorry people get disappointed when I don't rant and rave and talk at a mile a minute like Mars did. But that was acting.
Was it really a release for you, if you are as quiet and reserved as you say, to play this hyper type of guy?
I don't think it was a release at all. It's just that we had a film to do, and I was playing this role, and I had to do it.
How did you decide to dress yourself? Like, who was your mental image for the role, for the character? What kind of, you know, did
just
you
just look on any corner, see a young black? I mean, you see the sneakers they're wearing, and the nameplates and the hairstyles. You just look, it's there to be tapped.
There are already T-shirts with a line that you have made famous in the movie. How terrible would it be for me to ask you to do it?
I do not repeat that line.
Right, okay.
I've turned down numerous requests, but I do not say, you know, please, baby, please like the character Mars anymore.
Did you expect it, though, to catch on the way it did?
No, it's becoming a part of pop culture, language. You know, everybody's saying it, like the guy from, it's comparable to, like, the liar from Saturday Night Live. You know, that's the ticket. And everybody's saying it. That caught me by complete surprise.
You're just joining us. My guest is Spike Lee, and he wrote, directed, edited, and co-stars in the new film She's Gotta Have It, which is currently playing at the Ritz on Walnut Street in Philadelphia. I had heard rumors that in New York, theaters that weren't even going to be showing your movie were showing The Coming Attractions, because The Coming Attractions, the trailer was so good. I don't know if that's true or not, or just a rumor.
It's a half-truth. You don't have to show that film in the future to run a trailer. The way it works is that theaters are not owned by one person. When one person owns one theater, theaters own, when people own a theaters. It's a chain of theaters. So the trailer was playing in a chain of theaters. And this is one of the theaters I was going to play it in. So if we know that we're going to Cinema Studio and he has 900 theaters, he's going to put the trailer in his 900 theaters. So that's the way it worked.
You do the coming attractions basically in the persona of the character who you play in the movie. And you become what this character would be like had he been a filmmaker, and you're hawking tube socks to fund the movie. And you make a direct appeal to the audience to go see the movie so you don't have to sell socks for the rest of your life. How did you get the idea to do that? I can't say I've ever seen a trailer like that before.
Well, we had a investor screening last October to try to raise money to complete the film. And at the end of the screening, I got up in front of the audience of potential investors and said that if they did not invest in the film soon, I would be selling tube socks on 14th Street. So they got a big laugh. And then this past June, when it came time to think of an idea for a trailer, we used that.
Have there been any debates about whether your movie is politically correct or not?
No, but you're going to bring them up.
Oh, no, I wasn't, actually.
There probably are. I haven't heard any. I know that people probably... I was expecting a lot more flack from lesbians than I've... I haven't heard anything from them, but I thought I would get some static.
Yeah, because I'll explain that there's a lesbian character in the movie who's... Mm. Always trying to make it with the woman who has the three boyfriends. I have found that with some ethnic groups, that it's fine to be funny and to be funny about yourself, but you're not supposed to do it if anyone's in the room outside of that group. So among some Jewish people, for instance, it's fine to tell a joke in Yiddish accent or about the Jewish people or something, but if there's a Gentile in the room, you're not supposed to tell it. And I wonder if you've gotten that kind of reaction from any people since it's, you know, a black written and directed movie about, you know, with a cast of people who are black. And some of the jokes are probably in jokes to people who are black. Mm-hmm. And has anyone felt that you are, you know, that like white people shouldn't know about that, or that's just something we should keep to ourselves?
You're always going to get that. There was that was brought about The Color Purple, but... I think a lot of times black people spend too much time worrying about what white people think. And I really didn't care that much, and I just made the film the way I wanted to make it.
Did you have any trouble funding the movie? Yes, your eyes are getting about three times the size.
Is a Pope Catholic?
I've heard that he is, yeah.
No, it's a tremendous struggle trying to raise money independently. I mean, it's hard. Harder than hard.
What'd you do, too? Did you keep showing rushes of it to anyone who'd watch?
We had private investors. We had money from grants. We begged people. We got donations. We had contributions. It was a hodgepodge of ways of getting money. And it never came in one lump sum. It was always done in stages, a dime here, a nickel there, that kind of stuff, from hand to mouth, from day to day.
You call your production company, I think, 40 Acres and a Mule Filmworks.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the frustrations that are responsible for that name?
Well, it has nothing to do with frustrations. It's just a reminder. I don't know if people... know the historical significance of it, but I'll explain it now. During the Civil War, the Union, to entice slaves to fight for the Union instead of the Confederacy, promised everyone, every slave, 40 acres and a mule. And of course, we know what happened to that.
What kinds of locations did you shoot on in Brooklyn to help keep it cheap?
Friends' houses, the streets. This film was really shot within probably five blocks of of each other, all the locations and the sets. When you're shooting a film in 12 days, you cannot afford the time to be racing all over in your car, driving from one set to another. It has to be very close. And it was basically shot in the neighborhood where I live, where I grew up, Fort Greene, which is in downtown Brooklyn.
When a big commercial movie is shooting on the streets, they have police and guards to cordon off the area, and no one can get on and accidentally mess up a shot by walking past the camera. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that you didn't have the benefit of that. What was it like to do your film in the middle of a street where people are actually going about their business? Did that get in the way? Did you try to prevent them from?
No, it didn't get in the way. I think it added a lot of realism to the film. And if you really can't go in anybody's neighborhood and just shoot and be rude. What happens a lot of times is people, all they want to know is, what's the name of the film? What's it about? And if you tell them that, they'll cooperate. But if you don't give them that much respect, then that's when you don't get the cooperation that you need. Plus, you know, this film is really a guerrilla film. I mean, we had no location permits. We didn't have any insurance. It was non-union. So we were just shooting on the run.
Did you have to pack up whenever you saw police coming since you didn't have a permit? Did they check for those things?
Not really in New York. No, we weren't there long enough. We would just shoot, move on to the next set.
Guess you could have always said it was a home movie or something, right?
No. We didn't have home. I mean, we had the equipment, so they wouldn't believe that it was a home movie.
Did you have to crack the whip as the director to keep everything moving? You had so little time and so little money, you couldn't afford for anything to go wrong.
Well, it was well thought out. We took the time it takes in pre-production to make sure everything went right. And my associate, Monty Ross, he's the bad cop, so he was the one that would be cracking the whip.
Why didn't you want to be the bad cop?
Because a director can't do that. He can't be worried about that stuff. He has to just, the actors, that's all he has to deal with.
You were one of the actors as well as being the director. It seems to me it would be really hard on a first film to take on all the roles that you did because you were still really pretty much of a novice still when you were starting it, right? You'd done a film that had been on, I think, Channel 13, the public television station in New York.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't have a whole lot of experience, but here you were, you know, writing, acting, directing. Was it hard to keep all of those roles straight? Were you easy to direct?
Well, I directed myself.
I know.
Yeah, I see. It's very easy. The problem was is that when I was in front of the camera, I couldn't worry about the rest of the stuff that you need before you shoot. So Ernest Dickerson, who's the cameraman, he was the one that would give the commands to the crew that you need to give in order to, you know, roll sound, roll camera, you know, speed, all that other stuff.
Just joining us, my guest is Spike Lee, who wrote, edited, directed, and co-stars in the movie She's Gotta Have It, which is currently playing at the Ritz. What kind of reactions have you been getting from audiences? In some places, it's playing at the, you know, art house, like in Philadelphia, the Ritz is the place where all the art films and foreign films go. But imagine in other neighborhoods, it's playing at neighborhood theaters. Do you get a different kind of reaction?
We do, but I think it depends more on the racial makeup of the showing than whether it's an art house or whatever, a regular neighborhood theater. When the film opened in New York, we were first in only one theater, Cinema Studio. Now we're in 25 in the metropolitan area. Basically, everybody laughs at the same thing, but there are jokes that the black people laugh at the most. And I guess it's the same thing where if you went to Woody Allen film with his Jewish jokes, I mean, just some stuff that you look around, you wonder why everybody's laughing. But that is not to say that the film is not accessible to everybody, because it is. And another good analogy is that if you went to see a French film and you read the subtitles and everybody else was in the audience French, I mean, there's going to be some stuff that's just not translatable to subtitles. And it's the same kind of thing.
Do you think that having a movie with a black cast makes it harder to fund?
I mean, it does. Hollywood has this old axiom that black is really death at the box office. And if you don't have Richard Pryor, Eddie Murphy in it, you can forget it. That's the best thing that's about this film, is that this is an unknown, all-black cast. And it's killing at the box office. And Hollywood has had, they have to take notice to this. This is, you know, this is proving everything they, all these old, tired axioms that who knows thinks up, but they're thought of as law. And we're just destroying them all with this film. And it's not, black people are not the only people to go and see this film, too. That's what's astounding them.
Do you ever feel that in some TV shows, certain movies, and in commercials, that a lot of times black actors are supposed to play an almost cartoon version of being black? You know, we have to be like slapping five every second and...
Well, the reason that is because those scripts are written by white screenwriters and white people who are writing for television know nothing about black people.
Do you think that's what it is?
That's exactly what it is.
I'm thinking like in commercials too, like there's a lot more black actors in commercials than there ever were before, but like on a burger commercial, whenever like a black person's eating a hamburger or something, everybody's breakdancing. Do you know what I mean? There's this whole like set of behavior that, especially in television, I think, is supposed to accompany being black. How do you react to that?
Well, you just look at it and shake your head.
I guess it's hard for a lot of black actors to find roles. There's so few roles as it is that are good.
There's hardly any.
Had the actors who you work with had a hard time with that before?
Yes. I mean, if Cicely Tyson can't get a role, you know they can't. You know they're having a hard time. But my thing is that we black filmmakers and black people as a whole have to start making our own films. And outside of film, just providing our own jobs and stop being consumers and start being manufacturers of stuff.
This was your first theatrically distributed movie. Were there things that you really wanted to try out in the movie, either with the camera or in your directing style, that you know you didn't know if they'd necessarily work, but you really had always wanted to try it?
I had the confidence enough to think that everything that was in the film was going to work. There are things I thought about. There was stuff that, in talk with my cameraman, Ernest Dickerson, let's try this shot. I always knew I wanted to have the bed, one of the scenes, one of the love scenes shot from above, like in a bird's eye view. We knew that would be good. So there are a lot of things in this film that I knew that when the opportunity came for me to do my first feature film, they would be used, and I had to keep like a notebook and jot down things here and there that I would like to try.
How did you know how explicit you wanted to get in the sex scenes?
I knew.
How explicit did you want to get?
Well,
there's a lot of considerations there because you have the ratings and the film is going to be marketed in a way depending on how explicit it is.
Well, I thought that as long as it didn't go into area of bad taste, that we'd be okay. Unfortunately, the MPAA didn't see that. You know, the MPAA is a motion picture Association of America, and these are the people that decide the ratings of the films. And three times we submitted the film, and three times we were given a rating of an X. And then I had to cut a whole scene in half in order to get an R rating.
So is that what it is now, an R?
It's an R now.
Did you go in and try to fight with them about it?
Yeah, we tried to, but Ireland were not. It was in my contract that I had to have the rating had to have an R. They would not release the film without a rating, and nobody wanted an X rating on this film.
Can you describe what you took out, or is that?
No, there's a scene where Greer and Nola are in the bed. That's a lot of jump cuts where we cut back and forth from one end of the bed to the other. That had to be cut in half.
Are there any homages in the film to your favorite directors or to movies that you love?
I wouldn't say favorite director. I would say films I like. I'll say The Wizard of Oz. There's one in there. And Rashomon.
As I was watching the movie, I kept wondering how it would be different if you were working for a big studio that had the final edit, and if they were able to take you into the office and give you feedback about how it should be made.
This film would never gotten made if it had been done for a studio.
Why not?
Because they wouldn't want me to direct it. They wouldn't want no black film in it without Eddie Murphy or Richard Pryor. They wouldn't have wanted a jazz score. They wouldn't have wanted me as an actor. The list goes on and on and on.
Do you eventually want to do big studio films?
Well, I think I'm moving that direction, but it's going to be a natural progression. But when I do that, I will still have the creative control I have now over my films.
You have a few people from your family in the movie. Your sister has a small role. Your father, who scored the movie, has a role in it, too. Was it awkward to direct your father in a movie?
Mm-mm. He had that one scene. He got it right in the first take, and that was it. It's more trying work with my father on the music end.
What was trying about that?
Well, you know, we just have differences of opinion about what types of music should be used for some of the scenes.
Like, what were some of the differences?
Well, for the introduction of Mars, we have some kind of tempo, a rhythm, a beatbox thing. And my father said that was going to bring down the level of the movie having this bad music in it. And he wanted to write, you know, a jazz piece for it. And I said, Mars would never listen to that type of music. So therefore, we would not have this music, this jazz music, when Mars is in the movie.
So did you win?
Yeah, I won. I'm the director.
You grew up in downtown Brooklyn. Your father is
Fort Greene.
Your father's a jazz bassist. Did he introduce you to jazz music and to clubs when you were
Yes, I was. He was taking me to the Bitter End, the Village Vanguard, the Blue Note, all these places when I was 4 or 5 years old. My mother was dragging me to the Broadway plays at the same age, so all my brothers and sisters, we were all exposed to the arts at a young and early age.
Did you love them, or did you resent being taken to them all the time?
Sometimes we wanted to go, sometimes we didn't. But I'm grateful for that exposure at the young age.
Did you go through a period of wanting to be a jazz musician yourself?
Never.
Why not? Did the music not interest you?
The music interested me, but I was the firstborn, so I just made up my mind I didn't want to be a musician.
What does that have to do with being firstborn?
Maybe being in rebellion, you know, not doing the same thing that your father did.
When did you fall in love with movies?
I've always liked movies, but it wasn't until I was in college, probably my sophomore year, where I thought I might want to pursue this as a career.
Did you spend a lot of your days in theaters when you were younger?
Mm-mm. I mean, I'm not one of these movie fanatics that's been watching, just spent all their life in a movie theater since a young and early age. I was outside playing.
When you did go to movies, did you notice and did it bother you that there were so few black actors on the screen?
It bothered me. And same thing as television.
When did you become really like socially, politically aware of that and able to put that into some larger context and interpret what that meant? Did you have a big awakening?
No, it wasn't a big awakening. My parents, they gave me a good education, so they were telling me things, you know, at a young and early age, and we were just, my family's always been like that. My mother, my grandmother, she would color the dolls for my mother black. This was in the 1930s. She would color the birthday cards and stuff. Back then, there was nothing black. So that's the kind of, you know, consciousness we had, you know, from way back. And it's just always been like that for, you know, the Lee family. So it was, and there was nothing like no big revelation or that one day I'm black. You know, it wasn't listening to James Brown say a lot, I'm black and I'm proud. Then I said, oh yeah.
Did you relate to any of the Superfly or Shaft type movies? Because you must have been, what, a teenager?
Yeah,
when they
I didn't
were
go to see them.
It didn't matter that there were a lot of black actors in it.
It mattered. I just thought they were inferior films. I mean, I should have seen them. I saw a couple of them. But they were inferior films to me.
I was guessing from your movie that you liked a lot of Vincent Minnelli movies because of the... No, huh? Because of the... there's a dance sequence in the park.
But Vincent Minnelli wasn't only directed a musical.
No, but there was a real Minnelli look about that. The bandwagon, no. You think I'm crazy?
No, I just want to know why you chose Vincent Minnelli in particular.
Oh, because of the look of the two people dancing. It actually reminded me very specifically of a scene in The Bandwagon with Cicerice and Fred Astaire dancing in Central Park. Oh, well. Onward. Was there ever any expectations of you to become a doctor or a lawyer or anything like that?
No, my parents never put that on me. Whatever I wanted to do was fine with them, and I had their full support. I feel that's one of the things that holds a lot of people back is the fact that, you know, I want to be a doc, I want to be a poet or a musician. What do you want to be that for? You'll starve. Get a good job, you know. Parents don't realize what that, you know, what a kill that is to hear that from your parents, and that can make you pack up your dreams. But my parents were not like that. They always encouraged all of us that, you know, you can do it.
You went to college in the South, right, as an undergraduate?
I went to Morehouse College in Atlanta, Georgia.
And you were born in the South, but actually grew up.
Yes, I was born in Atlanta too, but grew up in Brooklyn.
What was it like to be in the South for a few years, having been raised in Brooklyn?
Well, like a lot of black Americans live in the North, your parents send your butt to the South in the summertime. So we were always in, spent the summer split between my two grandmothers, one living in Snow, Alabama, my father's mother, and my other grandmother living in Atlanta, my mother's mother. So it wasn't any big culture shock because we always went to this, we always went South for the summer anyway.
I understand that you're working on a movie that is going to be set at a college. Can you talk about it, or would you rather not?
No, it's called School Days, and it's going to be set at a black school in the South. We'll be shooting at Morehouse and Spelman in Atlanta, Georgia, and it takes place at a black school in the South during a homecoming weekend. And it's going to be a contemporary musical when it starts shooting in March. Island Pictures is financing the film. I'm writing the script now. We go into pre-production December 1st. And it's a $4 million film.
What are the characters going to be like? The main characters? What's the dynamic between them?
The main dynamic is this film's about class and color. So all the fluent students, the ones driving the BMWs, Volvos, Porsches, Mercedes, all going to be light-skinned with green and blue eyes. And the students are on work study and have no money, and they're on humble. The black underclass are going to be black. So it's a class color thing.
What class do you think of yourself as fitting into?
Well, I'm saying middle class, but I don't have middle class bourgeoisie mentality. So that's where I fit.
A lot of people who are middle class really are just hate to say that they're from the middle class.
Well, there's no need to lie, but I don't think like them, though. That's an important thing. I mean, I'm not going to try to distance myself from people who aren't as fortunate as I am, or when I become, you know, once I start to do more films, start to denounce or try to move away from being black, and I'm universal now, that kind of stuff.
Do you think that being middle class is inherently less black? Is that what you're saying? Am I misinterpreting what you're saying?
I think you are.
Okay.
What I'm just trying to say is that a lot of black artists, the more successful they get, the less black they try to become. This whole crossover mentality.
Who do you have in mind?
I mean, we don't have to name names, but okay. It's obvious. I mean, you hear it. It's reflected in their work, their appearance, the nose jobs, the cheek jobs, the lip jobs, the jerry curls.
Are you surprised that hair relaxers, so to speak, are back in after years of abandoning hair straighteners? There's the relaxers now.
The curls. It's disturbing. It's not surprising, but it's disturbing.
Are you glad you went to an all-black college?
That's the best thing that could have happened to me. My father went to Morehouse, so did my grandfather.
What was so good about it?
There's just something about it. It's hard to explain, but just being on a... I mean, ask somebody, what's it like, ask an Irish person, what's it like going to Notre Dame, or a Jewish person? What was that special thing they got from going to Yeshiva or Brandeis? Or Mormon, what was it that was so great about going to Brigham Young? Is that something intangible? But
you went to film school at NYU.
Yeah, graduate film school, NYU.
What was useful and useless about film school? Did it give you what you had hoped for?
Yes, it gave me equipment. That's all I wanted. I did not expect to learn anything from those teachers in school.
Too academic for you?
They just have nothing. There's nothing they could have taught me. I just wanted equipment to go out and learn, become a filmmaker by making my own films. And that's what I did.
You already have a contract to make more movies?
Yes, I have a 3-picture deal with Island Pictures.
Do you have any idea of, like, what you want to become? You know, do you have a model in mind? Is there anyone who's become the kind of filmmaker that you'd like to be?
Well, I would like to have the creative control that Woody Allen has. He has complete artistic control, and only one or two people have the kind of control he has in mainstream, you know, filmmaking nowadays.
A lot of reviews have referred to you as the Black Woody Allen. What do you think of that? How do you feel about that comparison?
I don't like it at all. It started in Cannes with the French film critics at the Cannes Film Festival where we were this past May.
What don't you like about it?
I just feel that that Spike Lee is enough, and Woody Allen has nothing to do with this.
Do you have to sell socks for your next movie? Do you think you're going to have to do that?
Allen Pictures will be financing the film.
Okay. Are you going to go see the film while you're in Philadelphia and check out what the audiences here are like?
I'm going back tonight, but I will be back sometime in the future. The film will be playing here a long time, and I urge everybody, please, to see it at the Ritz 5. She's got to have it. But I do make a point of seeing the film wherever it's playing all across the country.
Okay. I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much.
My guest has been Spike Lee, who is the writer, editor, director, and co-star of the new film She's Gotta Have It, which is currently playing at the Ritz Theaters on 3rd and Walnut Streets in Philadelphia. And it's a comedy, but at least a lot of people think of it's a comedy, but it's also a serious film, as Spike Lee has pointed out. And the film is called She's Gotta Have It. And thanks again for being with us.
Thank you once again.
This is Fresh Air at 17 minutes to 4 o'clock. You're tuned to WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is Charles Mingus.